before. They used to call us working class, but we're just not working anymore.
Hello, folks. Welcome to another edition of the World Labor Hour. About to in the air, listener-supported community station WFT, broadcasting from downtown Champaign, Illinois. The views and opinions expressed here are those of speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the station manager, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Now, here's Bob to give us some underwriting announcements.
This hour programming is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month at 9:30 a.m. at the Channing Murray Foundation, 1209 West Oregon in Urbana. For more information, visit www.centraliljwj.org. And programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour. And the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. and the Graduate Employees Organization Union, GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio.
Okay, thank you, Bob. I have a real quick urgent public service announcement I want to read first. We'll have some more later in the program. If it wasn't for the internet, we would not have the Black Lives Matter movement, as Martell Miller told the press yesterday. I look at the internet today as how television was in the civil rights movement, Miller explains, where it helps communities to be able to produce their own news, where the news is not just locked into one community, where you can show it nationwide and bring changes to your community like they did in Ferguson. Please come to the Don't Block My Internet rally today, Saturday at noon. We need you to stand up to corporate power. The corporate giants have dumped millions in lobbying these past few weeks, but we are still winning thanks to our call-ins and rallies. View and share. Okay, and please meet in front of the AT&T sign at the corner of Prospect and Market View Drive in front of Lowe's at 12 noon. You're welcome to add your voice. Currently scheduled speakers include Aaron Ammons, Brandon Bowersox, Ben Grosser, Amanda Hui, Gus Wood, and Martell Miller, and Mark Enslin. So definitely come into that, because this is about net neutrality, and it's very, very important, because we don't want them to turn the internet into like cable or satellite television where you have to pay for different levels. And basically what's happening, what they also want to do is create the internet and make it like a toll road, basically, to where if you don't pay fees and stuff, that you get you don't get access to certain material, that you have slower speeds and all those things, and we can't let that happen. And this is what's interesting. This issue is one of those issues that transcends all the identity politics and political labels, because 97% of the American people are in support of net neutrality. So that's really important to know. Okay, real quick, we have a special guest here in the studio. We'd like to introduce yourself real quick.
I'm Dorothea Schneider. I'm a core member and activist for Local 6546, AFT, IFT, AAUP. That's the Union of Non-Tenure Track Faculty on the University of Illinois campus.
Okay, and so you guys just had a rally recently, this last week on Wednesday, is that correct?
We joined the rally of our brothers and sisters from AFSCME, where also the Graduate Employees Organization joined, and other unions. So we were the frozen chosen out there in the middle of record wind chills, and chanted and made our presence known in front of Swanland Hall. What we want, especially together with AFSCME, is to propel the university to seriously negotiate with us on our contract proposals.
Okay. Yeah. Gus, you were there, weren't you?
Yeah. like she said, we were the frozen chosen. It was really amazing to see so many different groups, and this was such a diverse crowd. Students, faculty, staff, union members from both the trades and the crowd. I mean, everybody was there in negative degree weather, right in front of Swanland. It got so intense that they actually, this is the first time I've ever been involved in this, that they actually locked the building.
Oh, really?
Yes, they locked the building. Usually they lock, when we storm Swanland, they usually lock the offices upstairs after we get up there.
Yeah.
But they actually locked us out of the building this time.
Okay.
I mean, we were making so much noise and all this wind, and it was freezing cold. Mm-hmm. And we had over 100 plus people there chanting. Everybody was driving by blowing horns, because this is something that is affecting not only the people at the rally, but it's affecting the entire state of Illinois, that we have Rauner in coalition with the administration that are dragging their feet and negotiating with the workers for a better wage, for better working conditions. I mean, it is dire serious that we make sure we get this word out to people.
Okay, and so what are some of the contentious issues? Are you aware of those?
We just, a day after the rally, submitted our final proposals. Those are the big ones. We submitted 8 proposals. The entire contract that we propose is now submitted, and the last ones were the economic ones. First and foremost, of course, we are teachers, are the interests of our students. But in order to be most effective, what we need is job security. Multi-year contracts are an important part of our contract proposal for that reason. We need professional development, avenues for professional development that really enhance our ability to be teachers and researchers. No such thing really is forthcoming from the university so far. and we need higher salaries. Our salaries are very meager. I did some studies on our group, on our bargaining unit. We make considerable less than Champaign public school teachers, and most of us have PhDs and years of teaching experience. Mm-hmm. This has to change.
Well, indeed, indeed. Now, I understand, at least with the Ask Me people, that there's some non-monetary demands, if you will, that the Univali administration wants to do. I mean, I've been hearing about some of these, and they're like absurd, like some kind of after work code of conduct that they can use to try to discipline people and other such crap. Do you guys have anything similar to that going on?
In our case, the university's motto has been stalling and delaying. As you may remember, our listeners may remember, the university filed a lawsuit within days of the certification of our union. These lawsuits are lost at every stage by the university, are still ongoing. The university, believe it or not, is going to appeal our certification to the Illinois Supreme Court.
Oh, wow. How much that's going to cost the taxpayers, you know?
We figured that the lawyers' fees are about $400 an hour, and if we added up the lawyers' fees so far spent on this, we could probably have a very good wage proposal for our entire membership.
Wow. It just amazes me how it seems like the issue of control, you know, I think this is what a lot of it is that they don't want you guys to be organized. I mean, of course, it's the money issue, but I mean, obviously they're spending more money in legal fees than it would be to give you a decent contract. So it's
definitely
beyond the money. I think it's a control issue here. You know, it's amazing how they feel threatened by organized, you know, workers, you know, and I didn't realize that you guys were paid less than a public school teacher. I mean, in Champaign-Urbana, that's just, wow, that's definitely time for you guys to have a union, that's for sure.
It's definitely a wake-up call. I've also done some looking around into the data that the university provided for us. If a person has worked here for 20 years or 25 years, in some cases more than that, there is no higher salary than the person who was hired in the last two or three years. The wage compression is such that you make possibly about $80 more a year for every year of seniority at this campus. So that is an issue that our contract proposal also addresses.
Okay. And any last thing you want to leave with our listeners today?
Well, we need your support. We need your awareness that professionalism, respect, recognition, and a living wage ultimately is in your best interest if you want your children to be part of the future educated citizenry of this country and this world. We do our best. Well, we can't really function properly without the proper support of our brothers and sisters, fellow members, and supporters as we enter a very thorny stage of negotiations.
Okay, well, listen, keep us updated on this. You have my email, and you know, definitely you know, pass on anything that you need to get either out on the radio or for us to help you mobilize on.
I'm looking forward to it.
Okay,
thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, you just heard Dorothy Snyder, and she will probably be back to give us updates here in the future. We're going to take a quick music break. You're listening to the World Labor Hour on WFT, listen support community radio station in Champaign, Illinois. We'll be right back.
Chaba, 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 Chaba. Come on and wade in the water. Wade in the water, children. Wade in the water. We got Chaba in the water. Now a storm was coming, everyone said so.
Okay, that was Paul Kottheimer, doing a local musician and artist here in Champaign-Urbana, who's done a lot of you know, union rallies in the past and stuff. And that was a song he wrote in dedication to the victims of Hurricane Katrina called "Trouble the Water." So anyway, I guess we got some news stories. Gus and Bob, whoever wants to go first.
Yeah, let's go ahead and get started. Just kind of continuing off of what happened last week. We got some more police behaving as normal. That seems to be one of the actual
topics we're going to have almost every week at this point, because every day is something new. I mean, they're just increasing the brutality. A sheriff's deputy from Richmond County, Georgia is facing felony charges of false imprisonment and cruelty to children first degree after he allegedly handcuffed a 12-year-old to a basketball post and beat him.
What?
Yes. Whoa. Deputy Alton Walker, who has since been fired, reportedly went to a friend's house to discipline an unruly 12-year-old boy. While there, Walker, who was off duty and not in uniform, allegedly hit the child multiple times in the face with his hands and also punched him in the stomach, and Walker allegedly threatened to use a taser on the young boy. And the mother of the child says she wasn't at home at the time of the incident and had merely wanted Walker to talk to her child, not beat him. So a witness on the scene heard the child crying and looked over a fence to see Walker punching the boy with his fist. And in fact, he did tase him. So the witness also claimed that Walker used his baton on the boy. So he was not in uniform, but he brought out everything that cops use, his taser, his baton, and his fist. So we know when do cops actually go off duty and doing these types of things to African Americans?
Mm-hmm. that's the thing is that African Americans seem like they're definitely taking the brunt of this, but don't think that just because that you're Native American and Latino or quote unquote white, European American, that this can't happen to you, because I'm on Facebook, I'm on this thing called Cop Watch, and you wouldn't believe some of the things that I get across my Facebook page on a weekly basis of people that are brutalized by the police around the country. Mm-hmm. And all races. I mean, I don't want to minimize what the African American people are experiencing, because they're definitely the largest in the percentage here. But it's just that, I guess my point I'm trying to make here is just, don't think this can't happen to you just because you're not African American. The police are totally out of control. I think a lot of this stems from this whole mentality of their training, that since 9/11 in particular, I'd say probably definitely after the invasion of Iraq, all the police agencies around the country have been receiving military training to where they're training these police officers to act like an occupation army, and that the citizens of this country are the enemy. Well, folks, it's our tax dollars that pay the salaries of these police officers, and they should be, they're public servants, so they're supposed to be. And the fact that all these things are happening here, and it seems like accelerating at an exponential rate, this has got to stop.
Again, we have to be very transparent in the historical contemporary context of it. The reason why it's increasing, it's in correlation to the increasing slope of the decline of the working class. So again, you're looking at a power structure that is afraid that because they are taking away socioeconomic opportunities for African Americans and other underrepresented people, underclasses of groups, that they're actually trying to repress what they feel is to be an organizing effort to get what we actually deserve. You know, the colonized, as the Concerning Violence movie talked about, those that came out, the colonized recognize that they are colonized and want to overtake the position of the colonizer. They know that resistance is directly related to oppression. So that's where this is coming from. You're going to see it whenever you see any type of, I know we do historical studies of this, if you ever see any sudden shift in the political economy, if something happens, you're going to see an increase in different types of repression from police state agencies. Mm-hmm. It happens throughout history.
Yes, because the ruling class doesn't want to give up. And they've never given up anything to us, any advances we've made in this country. Nothing for the better has ever changed in the United States without some kind of struggle, for sure. Bob, what do you have today?
Well, in a little bit more good news, a deal's been reached in the West Coast dock workers dispute.
That was a lockout, wasn't it?
Some people some stories may refer to it as a strike, but the workers never went on strike. They were actually locked out, especially last weekend. They were locked out all weekend by the port managers there and stuff like that. So it says negotiators reached a tentative contract covering West Coast dock workers Friday evening, likely ending a protracted labor dispute that snarled international trade at seaports handling about $1 trillion worth of cargo annually. Says the breakthrough came after 9 months of negotiations that turned contentious in the fall when dock workers and their employers began blaming each other for problems getting imports to consumers and exports from overseas. Labor Secretary Tom Perez got involved last week, and they had threatened to bring both sides to Washington to get something done. There was rotting cargo and stuff like that in the ports. There were ships sitting off shore that couldn't get into the ports and whatnot. So Anyway, they signed a there's going to be a 5-year deal between the International Longshoremen and Warehouse Union, the ILWU, and the Pacific Maritime Association, the PMA. They represent the shipping companies and port terminal operators. It involves 29 ports from San Diego to Seattle. They handle about 1/4 of all U.S. international trade. So, they began negotiating back in May, and the 6-year contract had expired back in July 1st,
mm-hmm.
and the workers had been working on good faith ever since then.
Mm-hmm.
And like you say, been locked out last weekend and stuff. So they finally got it settled. Most of it really wasn't over salary. But as far as arbitrators and stuff like that, who was going to arbitrate disputes between the mm-hmm. two sides and mm-hmm. stuff. So that's kind of a little more good news.
Yeah, I heard there was even a shortage of Mardi Gras beads because of this.
Oh, man.
Well, among other things.
Yeah. Well,
okay.
That's good. Yeah, those ports over there do control a lot. A lot of people, like I said, a lot of produce comes in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, you know, I saw people complaining about no wine in the stores and stuff like that, you know, stuff. You know, our society, our businesses now are so much of this just-in-time inventory, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, automakers and stuff were having trouble getting parts. And, mm-hmm. you know, actually factories were threatening to shut down, you know. Mm-hmm. So it was a major part of our economy. So
mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Gus?
Yeah. There's a major story that's really developing out in the state of Washington right now that I caught wind of. This is another execution of a youth, but this time actually it's a Latino, and his name is Antonio Zambrano Montes. Now, what's really interesting about this one is that this murder actually has 40 witnesses to it.
Wow. 40 witnesses?
40 witnesses. On February 10th, around 5 p.m., according to Police Chief Bob Metzger, three officers respond to a 911 call about a man who was throwing rocks at cars at the busy intersection of 10th Avenue and Lewis Street. They also report that Metzger claimed that Zambrano Montes refused to listen to officers' orders to surrender. We all know what that means. After one cop attempted and failed to subdue Antonio with a taser, three officers chased him across the street and shot him in front of a grocery store. And people in that grocery store witnessed this, and they videotaped it, and the videotape is now available online.
Wow.
So at the beginning of the video, one of the cops is standing right next to Zambrano Montes, who appears to be holding a rock. It's unclear from the video if any officer used the taser, because the video starts after the taser was used. What is clear is that the police opened fire with multiple shots, as Zambrano Montes then darted across the street. So he's running by this point away from them. On the other side, he can be seen in the video moving at the speed of somewhere between walking and a slow trot, because he has been shot by this point. And the cops caught up to him, and right after he turned around to face them, the police gun him down with at least another 7 shots.
Wow.
So he's already been shot. He turns around and they shoot him again, execution style.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a firing squad execution. And this is something that is bubbling huge right now, because the story I'm looking at, they're actually calling for a lot of demonstrations in the state of Washington against this case. So
mm-hmm.
yeah, it's getting big.
Wow. Okay, well,
let's go back to some more kind of good news here.
Okay, we got the good news, bad news cops here today.
There you go. Walmart is actually announcing that they're going to be giving a vast percentage of their employees raises. So
mm-hmm.
it says Walmart is the biggest private employer in America with 1.3 million United States workers. Many of them will soon see a raise. Company said it would pay even its lowest level workers at least $9 an hour starting this spring, and pushed that to $10 an hour in 2016. Company said it would also strengthen a department manager role, giving it a minimum wage of $13 per hour this year and $15 an hour next year, thus offering low-wage workers a clear path to advancement, including similar bumps at Walmart's own Sam's Clubs. Company expects 500,000 workers to receive a raise at a cost of about $1 billion a year.
Mm-hmm.
So
sounds like a lot of money, but you know, the Walton family they have more wealth than 40% of the population of the United States. I mean, they need to have $15 an hour wages.
Five of his sons and daughters are like the 10 most richest people in the world and stuff like that.
So it's clear that obviously at this point they looked at their profit margin and said, "Hey, we made too much money this year, so we're going to give a little bit back." That's the only time they're going to get weight raises, is when they make so much profit.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, come on.
But I'm sure that this 15 Now campaign and all the demonstrations at Walmart's around the country over time has helped nudge them a little bit, but it's not far enough.
No, it's not.
Yeah. They say here that they're hoping to get a lot of good press about it, but they say basically they were forced into it.
Because, oh, they admitted it. Oh, yeah, wow. Yeah,
because, you know, they've been getting such bad press,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, people have been stopping shopping at Walmart and stuff like mm-hmm. that. So they're doing this to hopefully get a little better press,
mm-hmm.
a little better reliability from their workers and stuff. They're realizing maybe finally that paying a better wage and keeping better employees employed mm-hmm. there will go a long way towards building a better store and stuff like that.
Gee, what a concept.
Yeah,
are you kidding it?
It took them, 50 years to figure it out.
Yeah.
So, but that is good news. And they say part of it is due to wage pressures.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that unemployment rates have dropped so much over the last 4 or 5 years that they're finally starting to have to pay people to retain good employees and stuff like mm-hmm. that. So
okay.
That is kind of good news.
Oh, yeah, sure. And Gus... okay.
I'll
mention one other thing.
Oh, yes.
The U.S. refinery strike is continuing. Actually,
okay.
the United Steel Workers, they're expanding it. They're expanding the strike to the largest refinery in the United States. That's down in Texas. And as of tomorrow, I think they're expanding it to two other large refineries in Louisiana.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And again, this is a strike not based so much on salary, but on the safety of the workers and the communities.
Mm-hmm.
And mentioned that there was that explosion at the refinery out in California this week.
Yes.
Once again, they're concerned about the safety of the communities. At the community Torrance, California there, they had to lock the schools down and stuff like that. They told all the residents to stay inside, turn off their air conditioners, close all their windows and stuff, you know. So it affects, even though there was nobody killed at that refinery explosion for minor injuries and stuff, it affects the community and the workers there, you know. They say over the last 5 years, an average of 5 people have been killed in refinery explosions each year.
So, wow. Okay, I got some quick public service announcements, and then we're going to take a short music break, and we're going to come back, and Gus is going to be doing the second half of the program. He's got a special topic he wants to talk about today. Please join us for drinks and casual dinner to help raise funds for the Immigration Project. That's Saturday, February 28th. So that'd be next Saturday from 6 to 8 p.m., and that's at the 1712 Bent Brook Drive, Lincolnshire Field Subdivision, and the Immigration Project's a non-project organization providing legal services to immigrants throughout Illinois, including the Champaign-Urbana area. That's next Saturday, February 28th from 6 to 8 p.m. And this Sunday and every Sunday from 4 to 5 p.m., tune in for Labor's Worldview TV on Comcast Channel 6 and live at UrbanaPublicTelevision.org. This Sunday, in honor of our February Black History Month film series, is the film The Assassination of Martin Luther King. The Assassination of Martin Luther King examines the details surrounding the assassination of the courageous civil rights leader in the years leading up to his tragic death. It's a little-known fact that alleged assassin James Earl Ray retracted his confession 3 days after confessing to the murder. This documentary dives deep into the days of the civil rights movement with news clips from the time, numerous footages of inspirational speeches, and interviews with journalists and other civil rights activists. This film also brings special attention to King's heavy influence on raising opposition to the Vietnam War, economic inequality, and American foreign policy. And I want to highly recommend this film because, you wouldn't believe some of the facts that come out in this film. So anyway, tune in to that tomorrow, 4 to 5 p.m. On Comcast Channel 6. Okay, we're going to take a real quick music break here, and we'll be back with Gus Wood. Stay tuned.
On the top of your head with a razor, water hose, canine, bullet hose, tasers, whips and nightsticks used to enslave us, killing us softly, Roberta Flack, but they'll never be charged with a murder rap, never. It's open season on scams and frauds, it's 99 reasons to get ham from hogs, we won't see change without revolution, part of the problem's the solution, they punish the needy, and pamper the greedy, no justice, no peace, cancel the treaty, history repeats. Victory, defeat, we come to fight till the mission is complete.
When an unstoppable, a better they drop bombshells like aliens landing in Roswell. Reality is make-believe. Actuality is preconceived. When people think you're tough, they want to see how tough. You got money, they want to know how much. Whatever it takes, as long as it takes.
Okay, we're back, the World Labor Hour. So I'm going to turn over to our co-host, Gus Wood.
Yeah, thank you, David. As everybody knows that this is a very, very important day, a day that really revolutionized the change, the United States of America. February 21st, 1965, Malcolm X was assassinated at the Audubon ballroom while giving, well, right at the beginning of his speech. And what I want to do here is really put into context who Malcolm X really was. Even growing up, in school, there was a lot of negative connotations and a very homogenized viewpoint of who Malcolm X was, that he was a black supremacist and that he preached hate and all this other stuff. I mean, that was really the only thing I learned in elementary school. And from what I'm hearing, that's still a very dominant way to view Malcolm X, mm-hmm. which is very troublesome. And I've noticed that this is something they do to different revolutionary leaders, not just African Americans, but also any type of leader that wanted to challenge the system. Then they put them in this very negative light when mm-hmm. they're teaching in schools, which is another thing about public school systems, which I don't believe in.
Yeah.
But the thing about it is that what I want to argue is that Malcolm X and other black leaders like him, like Huey P. Newton and the other groups, they're very dynamic in their ideology in that they evolve and change over time. And you're going to see when I go through this that Malcolm changed over time because there were particular strategies of his social movements he recognized did not work because of who he was surrounded by and what type of actions he did. And he recognized that there were certain things about black nationalism that did not work, whereas in anti-capitalism did work because he saw that there were changes to a system that he could not combat unless he changed the system itself. So just to give people a little background on Malcolm and just to kind of put this in context, he was born on May 19, 1925 in Omaha, Nebraska. When he was 4 years old, he was already experiencing racism as his home was set on fire by a racist gang. And at age six, his father was assassinated by the Ku Klux Klan. He moved to Boston when he was a teenager. He shot around different places, Lansing, New Haven, Flint. There he became involved in things of petty crime, illegal gambling, burglary, and small-scale drug trafficking. But again, let's put this in the context. Like many blacks then and also now, he went to the East Coast and went to different places in hope of finding a job. Although drawn into the working class, the blacks always ended up with the worst jobs. Dirty jobs or the subproletariat, as Karl Marx and Martin Oppenheimer note. So if they were able to find a job, it was a dirty one. It was the lowest one. It was low paying, low skill, etc. In order to survive, many were pushed into petty crime to seek some type of income. And that still occurs today because of the issues of the working class and the removal of jobs from the political economy. So in 1946, Malcolm is arrested. He's charged with breaking and entering and other charges. And he's sentenced to 8 to 10 years in prison, where he ended up serving only six. So in prison is where we see the first shift. We see the first shift because, again, he's trying to address his youth at first by engaging in petty crime and trying to make himself move up the ladder economically. But when he goes to prison and joins the Nation of Islam, he adopts the name Malcolm X. And he ends up spending 14 years in this group. And within a short space of time, he became one of the most prominent figures, obviously. Now, here's where things get very critical. The Nation of Islam was a religious sect with the view that in order to achieve salvation from oppression, that you had to follow Allah and segregate yourself from white society and create a Nation of Islam. They saw black racism as the number one tactic to tackle white racism of the establishment. So when it comes to economics, they were black capitalists. So they used capitalism as a way to fight white capitalism. And they asked blacks to buy black. So as Karl Marx notes in one of my favorite quotes, social beings determine social consciousness. And the call to buy black expressed the frustration of the tiny, tiny black middle class who owned small shops in inner cities and ghettos. So now here's where the critical part comes in with Malcolm. One of the main obstacles of progress for black middle class to this day is the institutional racism. Even though the black middle class is very small, the limitations of this position are quite obvious. Above all, the ideology and outlook of the black middle class never attacked the foundation of capitalism. In fact, the real root of racial oppression of the African Americans in this country is capitalism. The group of black, the very small group of black middle class people to this day limit their attacks to the limits imposed on black businesses by white supremacists. So they're only trying to say that you're hurting our entrepreneurial advances and motivations with your racism. So that's the problem that Malcolm is going to find in the Nation of Islam, which is a group of black capitalists. So the black Muslims or the Nation of Islam were seeking to create an African-American bourgeoisie to confront white bourgeoisie. They were never able to see beyond skin color of the supremacists and never saw the role played by the white bourgeoisie in the society and also in the means of production. So today, racial class antagonisms are as evident as ever as well. The establishment of a rather small black elite in the U.S. represented by so-called leaders like Jesse Jackson has not lifted the majority of African Americans from poverty or oppression because they still live in segregated apartheid-like inner cities and they struggle with violence and drugs perpetrated by political economy. This tiny black elite has been used by the U.S. ruling class to undercut the struggle of the black masses to coalesce with the white masses to stop oppression and capitalism. So many black youth like Malcolm X to this day, and that's why Malcolm is so important for people to study, because a lot of the things he went through are very similar to the things that people go through throughout history. No matter what, even then, when Malcolm was young, and other youth, they're attracted to the black Muslims and groups like that because they're movements that denounce white oppression. They're not looking at the full picture of why oppression occurs and why it started because of capitalism. They're looking at the fact that this is a group that is powerful, they're collective, and they want to stop white oppression. So this had an enormous appeal on Malcolm, and despite the fact that he embraced Islam in prison and stuck with it until his death, his main concern was always to struggle against oppression of his people. So that's one thing that I really want to emphasize. That's going to be very big for Malcolm and going forward because he's about to break from the Nation of Islam in the 1960s. Here's where it starts that a lot of people don't. When people see the movie Malcolm X, they only think about the scene where he talks about John F. Kennedy, and that's where things started breaking apart with Elijah Muhammad and the other ministers starting to say things about him. But there's actually something else that's going to happen. In 1962, the Los Angeles police shot 7 unarmed Muslims and arrested 16 others. Malcolm went to Los Angeles to organize the response. When he tried to organize a movement that involved other faith groups, he was pulled back by Elijah Muhammad, and his attempts to go beyond the group would be one of the elements that helped to produce the split. One of the things that Malcolm used to do, the national issue with the Nation of Islam was that they did not want to work with other groups that were not about what they were about. So when Malcolm goes to places like local communities in New York or local communities in California or local communities in Chicago and tries to work through ideological beefs and get people to work together, you had the national branch of the Nation of Islam telling him, no, you cannot do that. So that was the ideological beef that he had going on in his head that forced him to start looking at things differently. And that's when you have the stuff he comes out saying about the president and also the stuff with Elijah Muhammad and the teenage women, things like that happening. So all that is what's happening. So he starts seeing a shift that black nationalism might not be the most effective tactic. So Malcolm X is seeking a revolutionary alternative at this point to the Nation of Islam, and he found no such alternative, so he walks away on March 12, 1964. So here's something that he said that was very important, one of my favorite quotes. No religion will ever make me forget the conditions of our people in this country. No God, no religion, no nothing will make me forget it until it stops, until it's finished, until it's eliminated. I want to make that point clear. Now, here's where you see that shift happening again, that he's changing. His religion is now becoming periphery to his central goal of oppression. At first, it was religion and oppression that were both fighting in his mind. But he's going to take religion and actually put it to the side and put oppression at the front, which makes him extremely dangerous now. Because remember, religious figures in United States history that are also movement shakers and people like that, they're considered safe because they have religion as their foundation. So a lot of the people in power are going to say they're not going to do anything against God. But when you put God not at the center anymore, more, that's when you can become dangerous. That's the way the power of elites think. So he also, so what he does is he starts Muslim Mosque Incorporated. And this is what's really interesting about this. It would not be enough to gather a mass movement of blacks against racial oppression. With this in mind, he's going to start this thing called the Organization of Afro-American Unity. Now, this new organization had nothing to do with religion. On the contrary, they appeal to Afro-Americans to join regardless of their religious background and call for the creation of a broad-based movement. So the founding of this program was deeply influential on the liberation struggles that were taking place in Africa at that time. So what you see is you're going to see Malcolm taking something and trying to make it global now. So again, he's getting somewhat into the idea of socialism, and that we need to start looking at this from a global perspective, that oppression is not local and not static. It's dynamic, it's fluid, and it's across transoceanic borders. This is very important for him. So Malcolm eventually saw the limits of black nationalism as a solution to the racist oppression that capitalism imposed upon the black masses. And you're going to start seeing a lot of his speeches now start talking about capitalism. This one is incredibly important. He talks about when he goes to Ghana, he talks to the Algerian ambassador in Ghana. When I was in Africa in May, he says, in Ghana, I was speaking with the Algerian ambassador, who is extremely militant and is revolutionary in the truest sense of the word. When I told him my political and social and economic philosophy was black nationalism, he asked me, where did that leave him? Because he was white. He was an African, but he was Algerian and to all appearances a white man. And I said, I define my objective as the victory of black nationalism. Where did that leave him? Where does that leave revolutionaries in Morocco, in Egypt, in Iraq, everywhere? So he showed me where I was alienating people who were true revolutionaries dedicated to overthrowing the system of exploitation that exists on this earth by any means necessary. So he also understood the rotten nature of what capitalism does. You can't have capitalism, he says, without racism. He said once in a rally in Harlem, on another occasion when talking about liberation struggles, and this is my favorite quote from Malcolm, you can't operate a capitalist system unless you are vulturistic. You show me a capitalist, I'll show you a bloodsucker. And that's a shout out to Sundiata Chajua, who we talk about vampires and capitalism all the time. So big shout out to him, my colleague and advisor. Mm-hmm. So again, this is something that's going to become big. And as I close this, as we start going into his final evolution, when he becomes a revolutionary socialist at the end, when this is a very short time period. It's only a few months before he's assassinated, where he totally drops black nationalism as being the cure all for racial oppression. So, nevertheless, the evolution of his ideology didn't stop there. In a matter of months, all that stuff is gone. Malcolm also stated that the OAAU had to work with other organizations, regardless of skin color, of their members, because he realized that the important issue was the politics of the fighters against white supremacists. His position on two bourgeois parties in the U.S. also evolved. While the black Muslims simply rejected The Nation of Islam simply rejected the Democrat and Republican parties for non-political reasons, Malcolm pointed out that both parties represent the interests of the mainly white capitalist class. He fought against black leaders who tried to tie the civil rights movements to the Democrats. He exposed the most progressive wing of the American bourgeoisie as the worst and most treacherous enemies of oppressed minorities in the United States. He pointed out that the Democrats had their origins in the slave owners coming from the southern states. And we all know what's going on with the Democrats today, that you still see these same type of instances where they are basically they're moderate liberals. They don't push forward with progressive agendas to attack capitalism and the things that are hurting the masses in the country. So again, at this point, he's becoming extremely dangerous in the eyes of the U.S. establishment. Now, and Malcolm X had lived longer, and you see his mindset, his ideology evolving. Imagine if he had lived longer. He could have started an uncompromising movement against racial oppression that was grounded on anti-capitalist lines, that he was going to unite the masses of both black and white workers. That was something that U.S. capitalists were very afraid of, and they were already witnessing radicalization of the black liberation movement by that point. By 1965, the black power movement is starting to emerge now. So Malcolm X became a serious problem, not only for the U.S. ruling class, but also for the black middle class leaders among the Nation of Islam, who were always bitterly criticized by him. His confused, though uncompromising ideas earned him a lot of enemies, and then he is going to evolve into a revolutionary socialist at the end of his life. So again, the main reason why I wanted to do this is to honor the great Malcolm X and to make sure that when we do discuss black revolutionary figures and other revolutionary figures that we don't homogenize their ideologies. We have to break down what their actual strategies, symbols, objectives are at different points in their life. We have to periodize the black leaders. We have to periodize revolutions and social movements, and we have to relate it to the political economy because that's how resistance develops and is sustained over time.
Well, that's really excellent, Gus. And I'll tell you what, two things that I thought was really interesting is, I saw that Spike Lee film Malcolm X with Denzel Washington. And in the film, they don't have anything about this, break with the Nation of Islam, about his organizing activities and wanting to basically go beyond the Nation of Islam. And the other thing was, they show that he went to Mecca and that, he met other Muslims from all over the world. Mm-hmm. And that's was, what changed his, outlook, where in fact, mm-hmm. it was this meeting with the Algerian, you said he was the president or
he was ambassador.
Ambassador, mm-hmm. Okay. That's interesting how Spike Lee wanted to change those two things.
At this point, I believe it has something to also do with producers, that pay for movies. When you sign the contract, you have to do things. Yes. But again, by doing that, they're really hurting the image of Malcolm X and hurting how we can study him. Mm-hmm. Because the things that, and again, they're doing that because they know that his strategies that he was actually uniting groups that were bitterly against each other at the local level. He was breaking protocol from the Nation of Islam and going into community organizations and meetings in neighborhoods and saying, listen, you hate this, let's put this aside, let's find one objective that both of you can agree on and let's coalesce it. That's a dangerous mechanism for social movements and organizing, because that's the one thing that we all can do, and that's something that the U.S. government and other Western powers have sought to try to break. Whenever there's mm-hmm. one objective that we can find to coalesce around, they got to find a way to subvert it. And I mean, so the stuff he was doing was so extraordinary.
Yeah.
Extraordinary.
You know, it's interesting too. I don't know if you've done any reading about, they know who killed Malcolm X, but they don't know who actually paid him to do it. Yeah. And there's a lot of different, there's one man, I think there was three of them who were involved in it, and two of them are dead, one of them still alive, and there was some theories to say that this was some kind of unholy alliance between the Nation of Islam and the U.S. intelligence agencies, or that maybe, no one can really tell me who got there first, kind of thing,
Yeah, the thing is that we don't know who was fully involved, but we do know the fact that because of his changing ideology and because he was shifting to an anti-capitalist, this is the same thing that happened with King, Martin Luther King again was changing. He realized that he said it in numerous speeches that what I had said before about Marxism and about the capitalist machine is not necessarily how I feel now. So he changed. So the idea of calling him a strictly nonviolent person, that is true. That was his central focus, is to remain nonviolent. But his ideological shift as he got older before his assassination in 68, mm-hmm. you're going to see a change in that. We got to start coming from this from a different perspective. Mm-hmm. So, and that's the thing that they don't want us to learn about. They want to homogenize leaders. They want to homogenize ideology so that we don't understand how things shift over time and learning how to organize social movements. We cannot let that happen. We have to make sure that we give these leaders and these groups and these movements their proper diagnosis.
Mm-hmm. That's very, very excellent point, Gus. And I'll tell you, I'm going to play a quick clip here from a song here from Twice Down, which starts out with a speech by Malcolm X. So you're listening to the World Labor Hour on List Supported Community Radio Station WT in Champaign. We'll be right back.
They put their club upside your head and then accuse you of attacking them. My brothers and sisters, we have to put a stop to this. And it will never be stopped until we stop it ourselves. This is American democracy. And those of you who are familiar with it know that in America, democracy is hypocrisy. Now, if I'm wrong, put me in jail. But if you can't prove that a democracy is not hypocrisy, then don't put your hands on me.
This time the revolution will be televised.
That's right. This time the revolution will be televised. Oops. Sorry about that, folks. So Gus, you wanted to actually talk about a few other things here in the last 10 minutes of the show?
Yeah, actually, you know, at the end of every one of the shows that I do, one of the things I want to make sure we emphasize is using the media as a form of resistance against oppression. And I think that we tend to overlook a lot of the film that comes out that is very anti-capitalist, anti-oppression. Like last time I spoke about The Outer Limits, one of the greatest shows in the 1960s that was extremely critical of capitalism, racism, things like that. This one's going to be a lot more explicit. There's actually a documentary coming out that screened at Sundance Film Festival back in January. It's called The Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution. A lot of people are really talking about this documentary as being something. The Panther movie that came out in 1995 was, it wasn't a complete picture of how complex the creation of the Black Panther Party was, and it was very Hollywood-like. Yeah. That's not really the fault of the people who made it because they're part of the Hollywood system. Mm-hmm. But this documentary is extremely, extremely explicit in stating how complex and complicated the things that the Black Panther Party were doing to help the masses of poor people, because that was their number one goal, was to help African-American poor people, especially with the breakfast program. So it's directed by Stanley Nelson, who won I believe it was an Emmy, if I don't quote me on that, but he won an award for his other documentary that he did on Jonestown, The Life and Death of the People's Temple. And now he's doing this other documentary, and it's already getting extremely rave reviews out of Sundance, and it's supposed to be coming to theaters hopefully within this summer. So it dives into a trove of archival footage to tell the story of the Black Panthers and provides new interviews that nobody has ever seen before. So this can be extremely groundbreaking, and the film intends to bring a fresh content to the group beyond the activity that you see about them in books and television. So, and there are a couple of clips online if you want to take a look at it, but I think it's something that we really need to look at. The only thing that I don't really too much like about the title is Vanguard of Revolution. Again, I'm not I don't believe in vanguardism. I believe in the will of the masses of society to organize themselves together and not be led by a vanguard. So that's the kind of thing. And the Black Panthers and Huey P. Newton, somebody who I could also talk about, he believed that as well in his evolving ideology. He broke away from the idea of vanguardism to believe in the masses of the people to organize themselves against oppression as well. So I hope they change that title before the movie comes out.
Yeah, just, the listeners out there aren't sure about the term vanguard. It's a term. And mainly it's a ruling elite or a group of leaders that basically make all the decisions, more or less.
Yeah, and those that seen Selma, we know that that's not the case. That stuff never works. It didn't work in Russia. It didn't work before. So, you know, I hope they change the title. But, yeah, so if you get a chance to see this movie, I'll be talking more about it as the weeks go on. But I think it's an incredibly important film, and I hope it's as great as they're saying it is.
Yeah, indeed. That was Mario Van Peebles that did that film, The Panther, back in the 90s.
And he did the best he could with what he was given. But
I don't think it was too bad.
It wasn't bad. It just wasn't, it's such a complex movement, and there are things that the Panthers did that they don't want to show. They show breakfast program stuff, but a lot of the movie was about the infiltration of the FBI like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I understand that's important stuff, but, you know, there needs to be more celebration of the great things they were doing. Mm-hmm. Instead of how they were broken up and fought, you know, that's important too, but we need to have a clear balance, because, I mean, the programs that they're doing are things that the United States actually adopted. I mean, they started the free and reduced breakfast lunch program because of the Black Panthers. Nobody had came up with that until they saw the Panthers doing it, and then it became a part of federal law.
Yeah. So. And what I thought was interesting too is that in recent years past, there was some released documents with J. Edgar Hoover's personal documents, where he found that the biggest threat coming from the Black Panthers was not the fact that they were going around in the black community armed with shotguns and pistols to patrol the police and stop police violence, which doesn't sound like too bad of an idea considering where we've come. But at this point, FBI Director Hoover, what he found the biggest threat was the breakfast program.
Oh yeah,
I mean, imagine that.
Yeah, feeding children who don't have food and water in their homes is the biggest threat, you know. I mean, you're right about the arming self-defense thing. Like, that wasn't even, a lot of people think that was the biggest issue for the Black Panthers. I'm so glad you brought that up. Mm-hmm. But if you read the papers about from the FBI, CIA, that was not the biggest issue. And big shout out to the Huey P. Newton Gun Club in Dallas, Texas, who actually patrol their neighborhoods every Saturday. They have their workout program. They carry their shotguns and rifles since Texas is is one of the only six states that can, that where you can publicly demonstrate with a shotgun or assault rifle. Mm-hmm. So, but again, yeah, you're right though. I love that point. That is so important that, you know, the things that they make you think are so bad about somebody is actually the most mundane and humanistic thing that actually pisses off the ruling elite. So, yeah.
You know, it's interesting too. I was talking to you about this, I think, last week about, when I was growing up, I was a kid. I'm talking, you know, like back in the 60s, I was like, you know, late grade school, early junior high, the propaganda that was coming out was that, the Black Panthers was a racist organization and wanted to kill white people. And I went to the library one day when I was 13 and was going through the stacks and found a book, a huge book with a lot of posters and photographs about the Black Panthers. And I sat there and spent 3 hours reading that book because, you know, it wasn't the actual, you know, text wasn't, cause it was, you know, there's a lot of photos and posters in the book. So I was able to read the whole thing in 3 hours. And after I read it, I realized this is not what they're about. They're about power to the people, and this state specifically black power to black people, mm-hmm. Red power to red people, and white power to white people. Basically, they're talking about the working class.
That's all it was about. It was about a working class movement. And the thing is that that's another instance where you can see somebody like the vanguard of the Black Panthers, who they did have leaders. They had Cleaver, they had Bobby Seale, they had Huey P. Newton, they had those different people, and they're going to evolve over time to move away from strictly African American working class to actually uniting the masses against capitalism. Mm-hmm. And that's what the free breakfast program, they saw that working. They were like, you know what? This is a great tactic. And that's when the infiltration and all the other stuff started. Yeah. And Fred Hampton's murder. I mean.
Oh, yeah. And you know, one of our silent, co-host here in the program, I won't mention his name, but, he just passed me a note saying he wonders if the ruling class were threatened by the breakfast program in a sense that it would extend, African American mortality.
Reduce
the mortality. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, of course, definitely. Yeah, because, I'm sorry. I mean, if you look at some of the things they were doing, they were handing out fruit. Mm-hmm. They were handing out cereal, grains, things like that. Things that you can't really get in black neighborhoods because of monopolies and capitalists putting fast food places and dialysis centers, taking up the whole thing, and people don't have transportation mechanisms to get to grocery stores a lot. So, you know, and they just not having the funds, so them setting up all these different things, of course, it's going to hurt it's going to increase the mortality, it's going to increase the vitalness, and increase their ability to actually organize against mm-hmm. and say, you know what, and be critical of their socioeconomic condition.
Indeed. There's an interesting film that I saw for the first time a couple of years ago. It's available at the Champaign Library. It's called American Revolution 2, and it starts out with the Democratic National Convention, but then it goes into it's filmed in Chicago, and it's filmed, I think it was in 68, 69, and it shows the Black Panthers in Chicago actually organizing a neighborhood of poor white Southerners that used to live on the near north side. Mm-hmm. They used to call it the Hillbilly Ghetto up there, mm-hmm. right around Wilson and Montrose, up kind of in that area, off of Broadway. It doesn't exist anymore. I mean, it's all yuppified now, but it was real interesting because these younger white working class, you know, teenagers and young adults who were originally from the South, you know, with all that baggage, they actually went and contacted the Black Panthers and say, look, I think we got a lot in common here.
Yeah.
We're being harassed by the police. We're living in horrible living conditions with rats and roaches and, you know, leaky roofs and all this. And, would you be interested in talking to us? And they definitely organized them. And, you know, it's a real interesting, film. I mean, in a lot of ways, it's kind of real rough around the edges, but, it's really worth, checking out to see more about what the Black Panthers were really all about as far as this unity, as organizing the people, you know. Mm-hmm. So, okay, it looks like we've run out of time. You've been listening to the World Labor Hour on listener-supported community radio station in Champaign, Illinois. And I want to thank Gus Wood for that presentation today.
Good stuff.
Yeah, and, you know, of course, Gus is going to be continuing here doing these special programs of his as time goes on and everything. And you heading out to that net neutrality rally?
Yes, I will be speaking at the net neutrality rally, and of course I'm going to spread the word that the